Why an empire at all? Why not simply a nation that leads only by example as the first among equals? How about equal amongst equals? Yes, I go for that. You know, empire didn't used to have a bad connotation. When Jefferson and Washington used it, they didn't look at it as having as being a pejorative. They looked at it as the empire of liberty, because they saw freedom and democracy and so forth gradually spreading across the globe. And at that time, you know, they were looking at three of the world's greatest empires, in the sense you're talking about, staring them in the face. Britain, of course, first and foremost, France, and Spain. It wouldn't be long before, after our revolution, of course, we almost had a war with France. We did have an undeclared war. Kim Jong-il got the bomb, and his family still rules North Korea. Well, let me not read any further. He has no oil and no Israel. Muammar Gaddafi gave up his nuclear program and was beaten to death. Yes, he also had light sweet crude. Saddam Hussein dismantled his nuclear program and was hung in disgrace. True, he has probably, by the lowest estimates, 300 billion barrels of oil underneath his desert, explored properly with Western technology, probably 400 billion barrels. That's the replacement for Saudi Arabia. Now you know why we went to war in Iraq. Have our policies made it clear to the mullahs in Iran that they must acquire nuclear weapons for their own safety? We're hoping that they don't conclude that. I think it's our intelligence community's correct estimate that they were originally thinking about a nuclear weapon only because Iraq was thinking about a nuclear weapon, and Iraq was their principal enemy. Now that we've taken Iraq out and thus destroyed the balance of power in the Persian Gulf and produced what we've produced, Iran has no reason for a nuclear weapon other than that intimated in this question, that we might invade them. If we can, in these negotiations, convince them we won't do that, we could get a win-win situation that we could all live with. But mark my words, go back to the agreed framework Bill Clinton negotiated with the North Koreans. My party, or at least a substantial part of it, and those Democrats who feel like they are tied by ball and chain to Israel, will do everything they can, even if we get the agreement, to derail it. And there's lots of things they can do. Deny the money for its implementation. They can deny the president the ability to lift the sanctions ultimately, and then we're right back where we started. What is a rational foreign policy with respect to ISIS? I want to say, leave them alone, get away from them, don't do anything, don't do a thing, don't arm anybody, put an arms embargo up, stop the arms flow, and tell the Saudis started this. Wait till you read the portion of the 9/11 commission that you haven't read. You know, the Saudis started this. 200,000 Syrian farmers had no water. They were living on about 2 gallons of water a day. Farmers. And so they began a peaceful protest. Others fell into it because they saw, wow, this is a pretty good thing going here. So we'll fall in. Basically nonviolent. The Saudis saw this and said, let's put some freedom fighters in there. Let's get rid of this Shia leader. And guess who put that idea in their head? Well, that's because we took out the Sunni leader in Iraq. And so the Saudis suddenly seemed to be being surrounded by Shia. Aha, Assad's got to go. We need a Sunni government in there. So the Saudis, Qatar to a certain extent, and others are as much behind the creation of ISIS as we are. We are from a very broad, comprehensive sense, but they are from a very up close and personal, here's your gun sense. How long was I in military service? 31 years. When did you learn there were no WMDs? I suspected quite early that there weren't any active nuclear aspects. That is to say, there were no facilities. There was software, you know, up here. People knew, scientists knew how to enrich uranium and so forth. But I suspected early on there was no active nuclear program. INR at State, Intelligence and Research Bureau at State, actually said there wasn't. And we put a footnote in the October 2002 National Intelligence Estimate to that effect. George Tenet couldn't keep it out. But I thought there were chemical and biological weapons up until the point where the inspectors came and told us they didn't think there were. And that was too late. How did you come to change your views on warfare and empire building? I don't think I ever changed my views. I felt like I was a soldier for the state as my father, my father-in-law, my grandfather, my grandfather-in-law, I guess you'd say, had been throughout their lifetimes. And I felt I owed something to the country in that regard. And I regret some of that. I don't regret others of it, because as I tell my students all the time when they come in and tell me they're going to work at the National Security Agency or the Central Intelligence Agency, I feed a lot of my students into the federal government. I tell them, yes, go there. How will they ever change if they don't have good people? And I'd say that same thing about the armed forces. The armed forces of the United States, especially its officer corps, are probably your most unknown and unappreciated greatest asset. Your officer corps believes the way I believe, almost to a man and a woman, with a few exceptions. It is just incredibly loyal to the civil-military relationship. Your officer corps will never lead a regiment up Pennsylvania Avenue to take over. You'd say, maybe they should, but they won't, because they are loyal to the Constitution of the United States. Their oath is their bond. That's both a great protector for the Republic, and it is also a great reason why their loyalty continues to go on to the man in the Oval Office, the woman in the Oval Office, with regard to war. Powell and I used to have conversations about this, and he would say, you know, it is marvelous that we don't have a prospect for a military takeover in this country. And the real reason for this is the very ethos of the American officer corps, Marines, soldiers, Air Force, Coast Guard, Navy. But that, at the same time, as I was remarking in the hall to a young lady earlier, is a negative in the sense that they won't stand up and say no more. We're not doing this anymore. It did happen with regard to Syria. It did happen, and the Secretary of Defense was right there with them saying, we're not going to drop bombs in Syria. Now, how far that would have gone is anybody's guess. I don't think you want that kind of mutiny. And I'll end by saying, here's a disturbing thing happening right now that probably maybe a few of you, but most of you, have no idea is happening. Walt Jones of North Carolina called me over to the Congress, and we went into his office to have lunch, and he said, you know, Larry, we just passed something here. This was a couple of years ago. We just passed something here that'll just shock you to the bottom of your feet. We passed an amendment to the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, that allows the armed forces of the United States to participate in civilian law enforcement. Under the guise of a very ambiguous phrase in the statute that says, if you can associate the actions with material support to or actual terrorist activity. Now you know why your law enforcement agencies are being militarized. We are creating a heavy police force, a Guardia Civil, a Carabinieri, if you will, inside the United States to help the armed forces of the United States when they have to do this. We haven't done this since Reconstruction. I looked at Walt and I said, Walt, tell me what the real reason for this is, because I suspected it was quite different than material support to terrorism. And he looked at me and he smiled and he said, Occupy Wall Street. He said, these people are scared to death of the American people and they want some protection. These people was 535 of your representatives. And they are. They're frightened of the prospect of you and others like you, to the tunes of hundreds of thousands, doing what happened during the Vietnam conflict, to a lesser extent perhaps, but nonetheless effective to end that conflict, taking to the streets and even having, you know, Kent States and Jackson States and so forth, people dying. One side of me says this empire of liberty is not going to be preserved unless there is some blood in the streets. It may happen. It may happen. I said to a friend of mine, a World War II veteran, 96 now, African-American. I'd interviewed over 700 African-American World War II veterans by the time I got to the end of this project. And every one of them, I asked the question. Think about this for a moment. I asked the question, why? Why, when you knew you were coming home to a country that would lynch you, to a country that would put your pregnant wife on a tree and rip the baby out of her womb, to a country that has not given you anything in return for the sacrifices you have made in every war this country has ever fought, every single one of them, why would you then go and fight for her yet again? And every one of them gave me the same answer, different words, but the same answer in essence. Because of that. Because if this country were to live up to her dream, if she were to be an empire of liberty, if she were to believe those words in the Declaration of Independence, we'd want to live here.